Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane. And coming up, there's a warning for savers whose fixed-term deals are coming to an end. Don't take your eye off the ball now or risk having your returns wiped out in a matter of months. Also, NS&I reveal the rate of the new British savings bond. Is it worth it? I faced a 75% broadband bill rise, says our Lee, but Ofcom saved him the haggle dance hassle. Meanwhile, Crane is back on the case of the unwanted SIM card costing hundreds of pounds. Lots of home news and the five TikTok money-making fads explained. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost-effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, this time last year, thousands of savers poured billions of pounds into fixed-rate deals. The most popular accounts, one-year fixes, are coming to the end of their term. But having reaped the interest rewards of locking your money away, make sure that you don't take your eye off the ball now, as many could find their money gets locked away again, or perhaps worse, their returns wiped out within months. Lee, Helen, welcome. Lee, what happened last year?
Well, firstly, George, I should say happy last day of the financial year. If you're listening on the Friday, if you're listening to the Saturday, happy new financial year. If you celebrate, if you're someone that gets excited by this stuff, it's like one of those dates that gets ingrained into financial journalists' brain. Yeah. It's like, I'm sure something's going on. Oh, yeah, no, it's just the end of the financial year and it's a new financial year. So, last year, what happened was we had that kind of run up to the new tax year in which we started to see, well, savings deals getting far higher. They were racing higher and higher and higher, and better deals were coming out. We actually had a semi-ISA season, really, for the first time in a long time, in which rates were improving. Now, what happened was a lot of money poured into fixed-rate ISAs, and especially last-minute cash. Lots of people sort of filled as much as they can of their £20,000 allowance before the end of the tax year. But inevitably, a lot of people took out one-year fixes. Now, what happens then, obviously, after a year, it matures, you get your interest payment. But some people just then forget about it, or they leave it, or they don't do anything with it. And it can be quite a bad thing. Depends on the terms of your account. But quite often, these fixes will roll into a really poor-paying easy access rate. So I have a little story about this from this week. So a family member who shall remain nameless was having some last-minute ISA panic, had some last-minute ISA panic last year, which saw them open a one-year fixed account with Santander, a cash ISA, because they've got their current account with them. The rate was fairly good. It wasn't anything to absolutely sing and dance about, but it was relatively good at 4.15%. So they did that. And then I got a panicked phone call this week. Should I be doing something with this? I've just like realized that this has just matured yesterday. I was like, okay, we're right at the end of the tax year now. I went on Santander's website for them, said that we need applications in before the 28th of March. A lot of banks will say that to make sure that, you know, there's no kind of last minute panic like this. Lots of people phoning up, jamming phone lines right at the end. They want you to do it as soon as possible. Thing is with ISAs, there's a lot more red tape than there is with regular savings accounts. So it's a little bit more complication. But despite that, so this money had rolled over from this 4.15% fix into this poor paying 1.2% easy access cash ISA. Now, you don't want to be getting paid 1.2%, especially in the market we're in at the moment. You want to be getting 4 to 5%. So I said, why don't you phone up Santander, do another one-year fix if you want to do it. They're offering exactly the same rate. I didn't hold up much hope, having said that, seeing that that message on the website. But lo and behold, phoned up Santander and they actually magically did it for a rolled it into another one-year fix, allowed more money to go into that one-year fix, sorted. Now, this isn't much use to you if you're listening to this now, because basically ISA deadline's done for this year. But it is a lesson in kind of showing what happens at the end of these fixed terms. A lot of people say poured in money. You might be someone that did it the other way around, put in money into a fix at the start of the tax year. So, for example, that Santander account was available from April to May last year. So some other people will be in that account. So it's just a reminder to go and act and do something with it. So much money went into fixed rate accounts last year, you know, an awful lot of money. So it's just a timely reminder, basically, to make sure that you're not falling foul of that. The next thing I've said to this person is, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to open up another ISA at the start of the tax year. We're going to move this, shuffle this around now, and we're going to make sure that you're doing this at the start of the tax year, where you've got 11 and a half months to decide what you're doing with your money, rather than like last minute, oh my word, I've got to do something with this, like, to, you know, to get another ISA wrapper to make sure I'm still building up this cash, and that panic, that last minute panic. But yeah, if you're listening to this and you might go, oh yeah, actually, no, I did open a 1 year fix, you know, or perhaps even longer ago you opened a 2 year fix, get out there and make sure that you're not about to get stung with an absolute rubbish easy access rate.
What sort of warning does your bank or building society need to offer here? So it's not like this comes out of the blue. You should get some sort of pre-warning that this is coming to an end, or not.
Yeah, no, you do. They typically write to you 28 days before the account's going to mature. The thing is, as we can all sort of attest to here, is that we kind of get lost in the sea of admin quite a lot. You know, how often do you get a letter through from a bank or a financial institution? You kind of really peer at it and don't really do much about it. Or you say, well, I've got a whole month to do that. And then, you know, you click your fingers and you've got 1 day. Because, you know, it's one of those things that gets shuffled down the list. So it's not like banks are hiding this. It's not like the old days where you'd get all different issues and you find it really difficult to find what rate you were actually getting. It's all been streamlined a little bit. And, you know, they have to kind of alert you to what the rate is going to convert into. At some accounts, they also, it's again, depending on the term, they might roll you into another fixed rate. You've got to be really careful of that, because if you don't want your money tied up for another year and you don't want to have to withdraw it with a penalty, you need to make sure that you're staying on top of it. It's just, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but it's just the whole sea of admin, Georgie, that we deal with on a weekly basis. Very easy for it to get buried down the list of things to do. And I actually think sometimes if a bank wrote to you and said, right, this is happening in 5 days, you'd probably act on it straight away. But I think sometimes the kind of like psychology of it being 28 days, you go, well, that's quite a long time. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's awesome. And then, as I say, before you know it, boom, time's gone.
Quietly. How does it compare, though, the sort of best rates then compared to the best rates now? And I assume if they do roll you onto something, it's not going to be their best rate.
Well, exactly that. Yeah. So, I mean, to be quite frank with you, the big banks have kind of stayed away from offering decent, easy access rates on the whole. That Santander rate isn't all that bad, but of course you can do better elsewhere. So looking at our Best Buy savings tables on cash ISAs, you can get 5% still, just about get 5% still over 1 year. We've got 5.05% here from Charter Savers Bank. But again, if you're listening to this on the Friday, you're not going to be able to open that up in time. You know, it's kind of, and from Saturday, there'll be probably a raft of new accounts as, you know, banks and builder societies look for a new tranche of cash, ISA cash, and look to kind of fulfill their coffers, and they'll have targets and all that kind of stuff. But you can still get, there's plenty of accounts that are offering more than 4.75%. Things haven't changed all that much compared to this time last year. We've been on a real steady ship. We saw rates sort of keep ticking higher all the way up to about October last year. And then since October, they've been back, easing back down, and they're kind of back to where they were this time last year. You could still get easy access cash ISAs of plus 5%. Outside of cash ISAs, there's a lot more fixed rates that are paying more than 5%. There's a good sort of 20 accounts or so that are paying 5% or more. But of course, they don't offer you that tax-free wrapper like an ISA does, which has become more and more important because of the personal savings allowance, you know, in terms of whether or not you're going to get tax on the interest you earn, which is way more important at the moment because of the high rates.
Talking about rates, National Savings and Investment this week revealed the rate it will be paying on its new British savings bonds. The bonds were announced, of course, by the Chancellor in the budget, now open on the NS&I's website. Helen, Tell me about these bonds. What are the rates? How do they compare?
So, as you said, these were announced by the Chancellor in the budget. They're different to the British ISA, which we, it seems everyone's getting a bit mad for sort of British-themed savings products at the minute. So these aren't tax-free. They're savings bonds, so three-year fix pays 4.15%. And they've also got the guaranteed income bonds, which pay 4.07%. That's also over 3 years. So it's 2 3-year products. They're not tax-free, but they pay interest each month. So yeah, not kind of table-topping rates. They're essentially sort of 3-year versions of the guaranteed growth in income bonds that NS&I already has, which are 1 year, but they were pulled from sale in October. So they're kind of a less good replacement for those in a way. They used to pay 6.2%, but obviously the rate sort of environment has changed, and these are 3-year fixes, so we're expecting rates to go down, which is why the rate on those is a bit lower. The minimum investment in these is £500, and the maximum is £1 million if anyone kind of fancies throwing that much money at them. They're online only, not via phone or post. So yeah, I wouldn't say sort of spectacular rates given given what else is out there. So, you know, as we said, you know, you've got 1 year fixes over and above 5%. So, but, you know, some people do like saving with NS&I for sort of security. And obviously it's got the kind of British angle as well. So,
Lee shaking his head there, Lee, as you said, the British angle, Lee.
It's just, you know, when like something like this gets announced and then the rate comes out a little while after and it's quite underwhelming. Now, I understand that NS&I has a kind of a goal to balance the sort of interests of, you know, it doesn't want to be tabletopping. We've seen it be tabletopping in the pandemic and money just pours into it. What I don't understand is it always feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity. So, for example, in this 3-year fix is just such a niche product. And they seem to always pick 3-year fixes the green savings bond. I don't know why they pick a 3-year fix, or you ask me why a 3-year fix is a bit niche. Most people would probably fix for 1 to 2 years. If they want to go long term, you probably go 5 years. 3 years is just a bit of an odd time frame, really. The fact they're not tax free will be a big kind of no-no for people as well. And then we only have to go back 6 months, as Helen said, about that 6.2% fix. And that was for a year. Now, that we keep mentioning this on the podcast because that really was the top of the savings market. It was a very, very popular product. Lots of money poured into it. People will look at that and go, well, hold on a minute. I'm getting 6.2%. Why am I going to open a product with a longer fix for 4.15%? It's not tax-free. And the reason I was nodding my head a little bit about the British thing is I can't quite establish what this money is being used for. I think it's just going to the Treasury. It doesn't, it's not, not like it's been earmarked or ring-fenced for anything. So you put all of those things together. And also premium bonds. I mean, the underlying premium bonds rate is still higher. It is higher than this. And I think people, yeah, you're not guaranteed the rate, but people were probably still more inclined to go, do you know what, premium bond underlying rate 4.4%, chance to win £1 million. If you're going to go an NSI product, you're probably more likely to do that. So there's all of those things. There's also 3-year fixes in our tables at 4.75%, the top fits, and then you got 4.65%. Then you start looking at shorter term fixes, and as we just mentioned there, you can easily get over 5%. Again, as I say, and as Helen said, lots of people do like to save with NS&I. Lots of people, you know, will see that £1 million, for example, that's way more than you're going to get with a bank or builder site in terms of protection. You're only getting £85,000 protection with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme per bank. So some people will look at that. But I think the fact that, you know, they're not tax-free, I think the other thing that I kind of, we've had all this before where they just decide to make a product online only. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, the very likelihood is you're online savvy, you're happy opening things online and putting money in online. But there's still a chunk of people out there, and I would say a big chunk of people that would use NS&I that wouldn't be happy opening online and would much rather phone or, you know, use the post. Now, that might be an alien concept to us, and you might go, oh, they don't deserve the rate then. But that's quite an unfair thing to sort of think about when, you know, there's older people out there that don't want to open these online. So that it's great.
Lee, can I just point out, though, it's there's a difference between opening something online and there's a difference between opening something online on NS&I. It is an absolute pain. And I'm not the only one who said this. Last time I moaned about NS&I's website and lack of app and technological advancements, I wasn't the only one to complain of our listeners. It's I don't want to say the word, but it's a pain.
It's a bit clunky. Let's put it that way.
That's a better word that I can think of.
So we have had people writing this week. We get people writing every week, Georgie, can't access NSNI online. I've had another message from my own mother this morning saying, I've had an email saying that I've won a premium bonds prize, but once again, I can't log in. And she basically phoned up the helpline last week, couldn't get it solved. I got Helen Corain, our savings reporter, to send her case over to NSNI, and someone actually phoned up my mum.
It took
an hour and a half for them to finally get my mum logged in. Yeah, we'll do a follow-up on this.
I hope she won a million after all that effort.
But now we're a week later, now she can't log in again. And now she's asking me for help again. And I'm like, no. So you're totally right, Georgie. It can be a complete pain. And lots of people sort of write in and say that. I think, you know, in defense of NSNI, you know, it has a huge customer base, and it's quite unusual in the fact that the first week of every single month, it has a flood of people trying to log in and check their premium bonds, you know, especially with more prizes now being dished out, you know, so it does suffer from that kind of, it probably has a quiet couple of weeks, and it has a kind of mad week where lots of people go in. But you're right, and I'm sure lots of people will listen to this will go, oh yeah, Georgie, nail on the head, I've given up with trying to log into NSNI and do anything with it. Definitely.
Well, and I hope they aren't listening. I hope that NSNI are listening and they just sort of do something about it. But
the one thing I was going to say is that, Georgie, the one thing that seemed to really sort of kick that NSNI website into kind of difficulties has been the two-factor authentication.
Yes.
That's what's really sort of done it. And it seems to have caused all sorts of issues. It sort of got rolled out pretty quickly. And we're quite a long way down the line since 2FA was introduced in NSNI. But yet we still get floods of emails of people struggling.
All right. Well, one sort of more positive saving story. Tips on your website for anyone wanting to become an ISA millionaire. Helen, who doesn't want to become an ISA millionaire or just a millionaire generally? I mean, but ISAs are good because Lee was complaining about four times, I think, you moaned about the British savings bond not being tax-free. Helen, ISA.
Absolutely. So this person has written into us. It started a couple of weeks ago. We wrote a piece with some freedom of information request from the wealth manager Baroon Dolphin, and they'd found out that there were 25 ISA investors in the UK who'd built up an average fortune of £11.6 million, which is insane. So these are the 25, you know, biggest big money ISA millionaires. So we wrote about that, and then someone got in touch to say, well, I'm not quite at those heady heights, but I am an ISA millionaire. And he wants to stay anonymous, which is fair enough, but he's given us his top tips for how he's done that. It's a really lovely piece, actually. He's kind of explained, the first thing to say actually is ISAs are 25 years old. Well, they will be 25 years old tomorrow. Happy birthday, ISAs. So he's obviously been there since the start, but actually that's like kind of overselling it to say that that's the amount of time he's built this up over. So he first invested in something called PEPs, which is sort of a precursor to ISAs, which came in the 80s. So he's actually had about 37 years to build up this £1 million pot, but still obviously a very big achievement. And he sort of talked through how he's done that, the ups and downs that he's had over the years. And I think before kind of getting into the ins and outs of his investments, the really nice thing that he said is actually, you know, I have made some good choices, but also it's about the way that I've sort of lived my life. So he says, you know, I've lived reasonably well. I've travelled widely and I've followed an interest in theatre, seen hundreds of shows over the years. But I always challenge expenditures to make sure I get best value for money, not always the same as cheapest. I'm perplexed at the sums people waste on things like replacement cars, a continual recycling of new kitchens, bathrooms, carpets, furniture, and so on. So I think he's clearly got quite a prudent and sort of sensible approach to life, while obviously still enjoying himself. I think that was just really, you know, he hasn't gone in and said, oh, I'm a superstar investor, I'm really smart about where I've put my money and that's how I've got this. And he said, no, actually, I have lived kind of quite a sensible life and I've tried to do my best with my money. And it's kind of worked out for him, which I think is just a really, really nice kind of story. So he seems like a nice guy.
Good, good. We want nice things to happen to nice guys. Lee and girls.
First of all, can I just start this by saying, like, the holy grail. I've had two holy grails in financial journalism. One of them is I'd always wanted to interview someone who's won £1 million on premium bonds, because we've never, ever been able to do it anonymously. If you're listening to this and you've won £1 million on premium bonds, please get in touch. It's impossible. The second thing is to speak to an ISA millionaire, because actually it's still quite a select club. There's only something like 4,000 people that are ISA millionaires. I might have nudged up higher. I think that figure was from the end of last year, but it's still quite an exclusive select club. And the way people have done this, as Helen said, ISA's turn 25 tomorrow. But before that, you had PEPs. And PEPs were the sort of precursor to ISA, personal equity plans. And they were able to convert these into ISAs back when ISA was launched in 1999. So most people that are in this millionaire category were investing before the kind of 25 years was there. So it was just really interesting to have someone write in and say, look, I'm an ISA millionaire. And it was a really nice tone of email. And I just decided that we would sort of publish his letter almost as a bit of a kind of an inspirational piece, I guess, for people that kind of want to know what it's like to be an ISA millionaire and how to do it. So he kind of wrote some tips. I'll fire through them really quickly just because of time. But he's got 8 tips here. He says, if you can, max fund each year in stocks and shares ISA. Well, that seems like a pretty solid place to start to become an ISA millionaire. Build up some deposit savings outside of stocks and shares ISA. This is so you don't end up with a fire sale when the market is off. You need more as you get older. Don't panic when markets fall. Diversify by class of investment and geography. He actually says here it's easy to be overweight in UK by the way of home bias, talking about all things British. And he said, actually, I'm guilty of that to a degree and suspect it's held me back. Despite him being an ISA millionaire, I fear here in this little sentence, he kind of felt like he could have been a little bit more, could have been a bit more in there. Contain costs by paying them from outside the ISA. So he says here, why erode the money you have in a tax-free environment by paying costs within if you could pay without? This makes a big difference over time. Don't invest outside your skill remit. If you're knowledge light, consider trackers. This one's a good one. Don't be a total skinflint, as sort of Helen was alluding to there. This guy sounds like he's been very prudent in life. You know, he hasn't tried to keep up with the Joneses. He hasn't bought new cars, new kitchens, all that kind of thing. But I'm sure that he has been generous in other ways. And in his email, he did say that, you know, he regularly gives gifts to his godchildren, for example. And the last one, which I think, you know, is a really, 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 really important one, is educate yourself on financial matters. You know, read and educate yourself about everything financial. I'm a better investor than I was 34 years ago. Then he says, ... or I think I am. which, you know, it's totally true. I mean, you know, even as we're always learning, aren't we, Georgie? I mean, every single day, I think I know new about the world of personal finance. We're always learning. You know, we're obviously very immersed in the industry. But there's lots of people out there that aren't in the industry who are doing things like maxing out their ISAs and building up a very good, chunky tax-free pot. Fair play to them. So, yeah, I really wanted to highlight this story in the podcast just for something really sort of like, you know, up and at them. You know what I mean, George?
Yeah.
Like, this is great. We've actually interviewed an ISA millionaire. It is possible. Yes, it takes time. But, you know, you might be listening. You might be 20 years' time an ISA millionaire, and this might have been a little spark that got you off the ground. You know, who knows?
Or even half a millionaire or something like that. Just an inspirational story. It's
I'll
nice.
Take that. Really? Yeah.
I'd take that too. All right, then. We'll put savings to bed for now, and we will be with Crane, who's back on the case. This time it relates to a TV, broadband and landline package, which came with the condition that your reader include a free SIM card. They never activated or used the free SIM card, but guess what? You know where I'm going with this. It wasn't free, was it, Helen? Take up the story.
No, so I think this is one of those classic examples of really sort of sharp selling practice from companies. So in this case, it's Virgin Media O2, and this reader has, she had one of those packages where they roll in, it's a TV, broadband, landline phone, and she got a call from them, her package was ending, and they were asking her to renew. So she said, yeah, absolutely, I'd like to do that. And sort of talked her through the deal, and they said, oh, well, to get this special package, you'll need to take a SIM card. And this realtor said, she was quite clear. No, I've already got a mobile phone contract. My husband's already got a mobile phone contract. Don't want one. No, thank you. The person on the phone, she claimed, said, oh, no, but it's fine. You don't actually need to use it. You just need to have it. So we'll just give it to you, she says. And, you know, that's fine. Then you can get this package. So, well, you know, OK, if that's the case and it is free. Obviously, as you said, she actually only realised. So she was paying this package for 18 months. Then it came to an end. It was just over £100 a month. And when it finished, she realised she was still getting about £35 a month debited from her account from O2. So obviously thought, what on earth is this? I've never sort of had an O2 mobile phone. And actually the deal was with Virgin. So O2 and Virgin merged, which made it sort of more confusing. She saw this come out from O2 and said, well, I don't have a deal with O2. So obviously queried it. And it turned out that part of her package deal had been this SIM card, and it'd been costing her, as part of the package, £25 a month throughout the contract. Then after that, they'd rolled the mobile phone element of the contract onto separate deal, which had gone up in price, and they were still charging her for it. So she's realised that retrospectively, over the 18 months and the sort of 6 months that it took her to work out this was happening, she paid about £650 for this SIM card that she never wanted in the first place. Now, Virgin's version of events differs. They say that they did make it clear to her that she was paying for this SIM card, but she's quite adamant that that wasn't the case. I just think it's, you know, I can completely see this happening. You know, you're on the phone, this person's trying to sell you something. You say, oh, no, don't want that. And I say, oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. You know, I think we've all had that when someone's selling you something, you think, oh, not really sure I want that. And I can completely see how that would happen. And then, you know, it's a package deal, it's all wrapped in together. You don't necessarily know how much you're paying for all of the different elements. And I think it's important to say this is a slightly older person as well. You know, she said to me, I'm not very tech savvy. Her son actually helped her get in touch with me. And I just think, you know, it's just a bit of sharp practice from companies, I think, to be selling people. You know, she didn't really understand what she was signing up for.
But even if that's the case, it's not like they're selling you something that you think, let's say it's the landline, they say, oh, sorry, you have to have the landline as part of it, and you go, okay. Yeah. It's something that, you know, you don't have to be that tech savvy to go, I've got a mobile phone, I don't need another SIM card, right? You would, you'd immediately say, I don't need another SIM card. Do you know what I mean? But I also think, do they not keep recordings of this? Can they not go back to their notes and say, look, we've got a recording of this? I mean, I suppose 18 months is quite a long time, but...
Absolutely. So I think the issue is that this deal was agreed over 2 years ago, and I think companies are allowed to delete those recordings after 2 years. But they've said that they wouldn't tell me what records they would, but they said our records show that she was aware of what she was paying, but unclear whether that means, you know, she was aware of the monthly cost of the package, but she was, you know, she was always aware of what she was paying every month. She just didn't realize that £25 of that was for a SIM that she didn't want. So I think it's a bit of they told her what she was going to be charged and she paid that. But she didn't realise that something she didn't want was making about a quarter of that money. And actually, since I've written this, I was having a look at the comments earlier, and an awful lot of people have said that a similar thing has happened to them with a SIM, and not just with Virgin, with other companies as well. So it does seem like, you know, maybe companies are trying to kind of talk people into a bit having a SIM card they don't necessarily want. I can completely sort of see that happening. And yeah, it seems like I've maybe kind of hit on something here. This is, because people do like doing a package deal. You're not necessarily getting the cheapest deal possible, but, you know, rolling everything into one, it's a bit easier. It's a bit less hassle. But if they start putting in things that you actually don't want and are paying for, then I think it probably causes people to think twice.
What was the outcome of this? What did Virgin Media O2 say, apart from the fact they said that, you know, we were totally legit?
Yeah, so they said... they disagreed that she was not properly informed about the SIM card. They said she received clear information on the services she was buying, including the O2 contract and confirmation of the direct debit. However, having spoken with her and understanding she does not require the SIM, we've decided to offer a full refund as a gesture of goodwill on this occasion.
gesture of goodwill on this occasion. Yep. Yes, quite. Okay, well, I suppose a good outcome, but I would imagine there's more to this, Helen. Something to watch out for. But it does, Lee, go to show the importance of just being really aware of your bills and what's coming out. We have a sort of case of your own. Talk to us about that.
I will do, yeah. So just quickly, just back on the Helen case, I think what the kind of what's been happening, especially with a lot of salespeople, is that they're kind of bundling things together, and a lot of people are kind of getting a bit baffled by what makes up what part of the elements. We're talking like TV, broadband, mobile, you know, all sorts of utilities that kind of get bundled in, and you don't quite realise what part of what, you know, what money is paying for what part of the bill, and it starts to get quite complicated and you start getting quite baffled by it. So I think that's what's happened in that case. You know, they were kind of told to have the SIM card. They said they didn't really need it, but it's kind of like, well, you need it to sign up for this kind of like special package. And I think there's been a bit of that going on, and that seems to be the kind of general consensus in some of the comments that we're receiving about this. Now, my own personal case, we were talking about Sea of Admin earlier, and this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about here. I got an email a couple of weeks ago from Plusnet. Now, I've been with Plusnet ever since I've moved into the house that we live in now, which was about 8 years ago. The service has always been very good. I've always had very good internet connection, touch wood. I've had no real cause for complaint. But what happens is I always end up going into a sort of 18-month or 24-month contract. Inevitably, it rolls around, and then you get a message saying it's going up by a certain amount of money. Now, this time round, they were trying to put on a 75% rise as I came out of contract at the end of April. So I was paying £30.99 a month, which has gone up from when I first signed the deal because of RPI-linked rises, which basically every single telecoms giant bakes into contracts. We've spoken about this before. There's meant to be a bit of a crackdown on that happening. To £54.39 a month. I ain't paying £54 a month for broadband. Yes, broadband is a vital service. Yes, you know, we need a good connection more so than ever before. But it was for the exact same package, unlimited fibre extra. So I'd be paying far more for the exact same service. Not 75% quicker broadband, not 75% better service, absolutely nothing different, other than I would be hit with a sucker penalty if I didn't do anything. Yeah. Now,
wow,
that first half of that email really, really got me going. You know, as a financial journalist, I do keep on top of a lot of the financial admin in this household, which I don't mind doing at all. It's not a problem. You know, I'm fairly good at acting and doing things fairly quickly. Journalists are famously bad for doing things very last minute, which I am when it comes to work things. But sometimes, in like, I can't let things like that ride. I don't want to be paying 75% more. If that hits me right in the pocket, you know, we're talking about, over, you know, the course of a year, you're talking about £300 extra. I mean, I was like no, I'm not doing it. So anyway, read the first half of the email. I was like, okay, blood pressure's rising. This is really, really irritating. Then there was a little life ring at the bottom of the email. And this is why it's important to, A, click on the emails that you get from your the companies that you deal with. It's quite easy just to go, oh, it's just another bill or whatever, I'm not opening it up. Because I get sent a monthly bill, and I hardly ever open it, if I'm being quite honest, because nothing's really changed. But I open this one up. But it also shows the importance of getting right down to the bottom of the email where a life ring might sit. So under a header titled, here is your best price, then in brackets, in line with Ofcom guidance, it said, unlimited fiber extra broadband, so exactly the same broadband that I currently have, and line rental for £25.99 a month. Increases from the 31st of March 2025, which will be those baked in RPI rises, 18-month contract. So not only is there a cheaper option for me than I'm currently on, where I've had those rises, those RPI rises, but it's so much cheaper than what it was trying to get me to do. So I just thought, do you know what? Back in the day, I've had to haggle with Plusnet. I've had to haggle with lots of financial providers in the past where I'm actually pleasantly happy staying with them, but I'm not happy paying a whack more for the same thing. So it just said, blob of text under that, just said, renew my contract now. And I just thought, all right then. And it took seconds. I mean,
it's tough. You'd feel so peed off that you wouldn't want to be stay with them, but then you think, well,
the price is good, so
yeah, I mean, exactly.
But it's kind of like, so on one hand you could kind of say, you know, broadband providers shouldn't have such ridiculously loyalty penalties, you know, out of contract price rises, you know, and that Ofcom watchdogs should be cracking down a bit on that. And it had to be fair, it's done quite a lot of work in all of these different kind of utility bills. And I've been critical of Ofcom in the past, especially things like line rental, which a fair few years ago I wrote a very scathing piece about how could line rental just keep going up and up and up and up, right? But you know, credit where credit's due a little bit here. You know, this is the next best step from making these loyalty penalties not exist. You know, it's an easy way for households to renew, save money, and also save time. Because in the past, I would have had to do the whole haggle dance, which is you phone up, I'm going to leave. Unless you do get lower bill, I'm going to have to leave. But which is all fine. But of course, it takes ages to get through. You might give up. You get directed onto chatbots. You know, by the time you've done all that, you're just sort of like, you're losing the will. You know, this is just great. So this is perfect for someone like me. I'm saving money. I'm happy with the service. I'm annoyed that you've tried to crank this up to this. But luckily, not luckily, but like great work that there's this little thing at the bottom saying, renew here for this better price. Now, while I'm at it, while I'm on the utilities sort of front, don't forget your mobile phone as well. So Helen was talking there about SIM cards. So many people have phone contracts, then go out of contract and stay on the contract. I don't understand it at all, right? I think people get a bit confused about this. And my own wife was a little bit confused about this recently, right? So you're paying for the handset and you're paying for the minutes and the data and everything else that comes with it. But once your contract's over, you've paid the handset off. You now own the phone. You know, you've now got it. You can now change onto a SIM-only deal. SIM-only deals are, on the whole, so much cheaper than just being on the contract because you're not paying for the handset anymore. Now, lots of people just kind of let it roll over and they don't quite, you know, they're happy with the phone. And the big one is, I don't want to lose all my pictures. I'm going to have to take ages like uploading them and sorting them all out. But if you're happy with the phone, just get yourself onto a far cheaper SIM-only contract. Mm-hmm. Now, you can actually find out if you're out of contract or in contract. All you have to do is text info to 85075. I tried this out. I knew I was still in contract, but I thought I'd check it out just to make sure it works. And it's all good. And it did. I got a message back from my mobile phone provider almost instantly telling me how much I'd have to pay to come out of contract. But if you're out of contract, it will just say zero. It will cost you zero. So, you know, just little nuggets like that of a little bit of financial admin could save you a lot of money. It could be the difference between paying 30, 40, 50 quid a month for a phone, especially if you've got the latest iPhone or you've got, you know, the latest Samsung Galaxy, you know. If you've now paid the handset off and then you can switch onto a £10 a month SIM-only deal, absolutely no difference to your life whatsoever other than you're saving money. You can keep your same phone number. They've made it 1,000 times easier to keep your phone number now. That used to all be a hassle, like trying to keep hold of the number. They've made all that easy. So there's no excuse to make sure that you're not overpaying. And it's, again, just a little gentle reminder to do that.
And your phone is a really useful tool because it's got a calendar in it. And you can put reminders in your phone when your deals are up and the week before and all. That's what I do anyway, Lee. Lee, you're not convinced about that?
That's really organised. No, Georgia, I'm really convinced by that. I think that's a top tip. It's just no idea.
If it's not in my diary, calendars. It doesn't happen.
I'm all for my diaries and calendars. I'm not good. I like, you know.
Colour-coded as well, Lee.
I book an appointment for something and then it just lives in my head until like the day before. I'm like, that date's on. Oh, yeah, I've got something going on tomorrow. Yeah, no, not good with the calendar. No, yeah.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Rob, welcome to the podcast. Now, investors are often advised to make sure they beat the deadline at the end of the tax year, but what should they do at the start of the tax year?
Well, the start of the tax year is very much a time for planning ahead. So your allowances, so the amount you can put into an ISA or a pension, for instance, reset on the 6th of April. There's a brand new ISA allowance of £20,000, for instance. So it's a time potentially to use these to make your finances as tax efficient as possible, as early as possible. And with both the dividend and the capital gains tax allowances being cut again this year, that could be particularly valuable. In the case of using a stocks and shares ISAs, for instance. So if you've got cash available at this point and you know you can spare it, then you could consider putting that to work early.
And does being an early bird pay off for investors?
Well, being an early bird means your money is invested and working for you that bit longer. So you can start to benefit from the compounding of returns from an earlier point. And this can be an advantage, although it's not clear cut, especially in the short term, because of the vagaries of markets. However, if you're consistently an early bird over many years, investing your full ISA allowance or as much as you can afford to, as early in the tax year as possible, that can help you achieve your investing goals faster. It's up to an extra year of investment, which when averaged out and compounded over the years can make quite a bit of difference.
Okay, thank you very much, Rob.
Welcome back. A mixed bag of housing news this week. Mortgage approvals hit a 17-month high in February in what could be a sign of the property market bouncing back. Nationwide, meanwhile, says house prices fell slightly in March, picture being worse in the south than the north. And first-time buyers made up a third of all purchases. In London, it's half. Helen, mix it all together. What does it mean?
So people have taken this as a bit of a sign that the housing market is maybe bouncing back. So to look at the figures we have, the government figures, the ONS figures for February, so they normally work on a slight delay. They've said the mortgage approvals, so this is people who've got a mortgage signed off by the bank for house purchases, so it doesn't include remortgages, they hit a 17-month high in February. That's year on year, so compared to February last year. People are buying more houses, it appears, you know, the mortgage rates are going down compared to where they were, say, a year ago. So that's partly why we've seen this bounce in approvals. You know, if we look at where we were a year ago, we were not long after the sort of crazy mini budget, the effects of that were still sort of filtering out, and mortgage rates are really, really high. So we were talking 6% plus in some cases. That's come down to around about, you know, you can get rates just over 4.5%, 5%. So still much, much higher than people are used to. But I think people are finding those a little bit more palatable. But if we look back a bit further, you know, this is really just going back to normal market levels. So before, you know, before this mini budget stuff happened, before rates started really, really rocketing. So it would be wrong to sort of see this as a big sort of housing market boom. It's things kind of getting a bit closer to being back to normal, I suppose, after all the mortgage rate kind of turmoil over the last few years. Yeah, so it's, you know, things are kind of slightly looking up, but they're not. It's certainly not a huge kind of party in the housing market. It's, you know, people are thinking, you know, this looks like what mortgage rates are going to be for the foreseeable future. And if I want to buy a house, if I want to move, it seems like things are, if not ideal, a bit stable. So I've decided to kind of make my move, I think is what's happening here.
So Lee, I mean, talking about party in the housing market, is it parties for first-time buyers? Was Sir Howard Davis, the NatWest chairman, who said that it actually wasn't that hard to get on the housing ladder nowadays, was he right?
I've forgotten about that, Georgie. Good little reference there. Very nice. Well, yeah, it's the figures that we've had last week, quite interesting from Hampton, saying that one in three homes sold so far this year have gone to first-time buyers, 33% exactly, which is an all-time high. It's up from 29% last year and just 17% in 2014. That's quite a big leap. And the research suggests that the increase has been driven by first-time buyers in the south. And for the first time, half of homes in London were bought by first-time buyers, which I think is quite an interesting statistic. Now, actually, they break it down in this piece of research of the real first-time buyer hotspots. So this is research, as I say, from Hamptons. Number one, I think this is really, really interesting. Slough, 89% went to first-time buyers so far this year. I mean, it'd be a mix, I guess. There must be quite a few, if there's people in the know who listen to this in and around Slough, I'm guessing there must be quite a few new builds getting built up around there. Potentially could be behind the quirk. But there's other little pockets as well. I mean, that is the real outlier, the Slough figure. You've got Wandsworth, 72%. That's a 25% year-on-year change. And Braintree in Essex, not a million miles away from me here, 70%. That's up 28% annually. Brent, 68%. Greenwich, 68%. Reigate and Banstead, 68%. Newham, 68%. Havering, 65%. That's some big numbers of first-time buyers. And it's quite encouraging that people are managing to potentially be getting on the market. Now, it would be a mix of people potentially using things like Lifetime ISAs. You think when Lifetime ISAs launched, we've now had a fair few years since that, and the likelihood is people have actually potentially been able to build up fairly sizable deposits by now having used something like that. We've also, house prices in London have outperformed the rest of the UK quite a bit over the last decade compared to what it was doing before that. So again, another interesting piece of information in here. So far this year, the typical London first-time buyer spent £108,710 less on their property than they did in 2020, when mortgage rates were more affordable. And that's quite a sizable chunk of money that's potentially getting saved. So a little chink of light here, I guess, and encouraging that first-time buyers are getting onto the market. But, you know, again, as we always say, the slight worry is, are people overstretching themselves? You know, we were at a stage at the moment where mortgage rates have gone up compared to where they were sort of 18 months, 2 years ago. But then we have affordability checks. And as we always say on this podcast, George, you'd never be afraid to go and buy your first home, because you could sit on the fence forever hoping that house prices could fall, hoping that mortgage rates could fall. You know, if you need a home and you want to buy a home and you've got the means necessary to do it and you've got the finances, then go for it. And this is what this Hamptons piece of research, in my mind, is showing us.
Good advice, Ellie, as always. Finally, one for the kids, I think. I don't know about you guys. I tried TikTok. I posted, I think, maybe like 4 times. It's like, it was just a bit frenetic, I found. But look, people love it. People make a lot of money from it. People also give a lot of money advice on it, so I understand. And as you would imagine, not all of it is sound advice. How do you sort the wheat from the chaff? Well, you've been speaking to an entrepreneur who gave his views. Helen, TikTok?
Not really. I mean, I have a TikTok. Do I ever post on it? No. Do I fully understand the things that other people post on it and why they're funny? No. But as you say, very popular, and actually becoming increasingly popular for young people looking for financial advice, advice on side hustles, how to make money, and good and bad advice out there. Obviously, we've run pieces on this before, you know, beware of taking investment tips from TikTok, obviously, things like that. But what this piece is really talking about, so this is by the entrepreneur Tim Armu, and he's specifically talking about people on TikTok who are trying to promote different side hustles. So saying, you know, you can make loads of money without much effort if you do X. It's kind of like the modern version of like multi-level marketing scheme type things. It's like, do you not have very much time and want to make loads of money? Why don't you, know, do this? So the kinds of things that people are talking about here, he's gone through a few different things that people are apparently really pushing on TikTok as good ways to make money, and he's kind of given his verdict. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? So just to run through them, the first one is become an Amazon affiliate, which is basically you choose a product on Amazon and you apply to become an affiliate, which basically means that you post a link to that product on websites other than Amazon. Then when people click on that link and buy the product, you get a cut of the money from the company that's selling it. So if you can post a link somewhere, this is how a lot of influencers make money, right? So they'll say, oh, look at this product. They'll post it on their story or whatever. Loads will go and buy it and they get a cut of the money. So Tim Armu's verdict on this, though, is this is TikTok level bad. It's actually against the terms of service for Amazon and on Pinterest, which is where a lot of people will go and post these links. And it will result in you getting banned from both platforms. So he says affiliate marketing is a great way to make money, but doing it in that specific way, you know, just spamming a link off somewhere and hoping that loads of people will click on it, not a good idea. So it takes a lot more nuance, and he goes through how to do it. So he says, you know, pick something really specific and, you know, create some kind of content that people actually want about that product. So maybe create, his example is, if you're selling, you know, tools for gardening, create a guide how to, I don't know, plant buddleias in your garden, and then link to the product through that. It's something that is useful to people, you know, gives you a bit of value, and then they might actually want to buy your product. The second thing he talks about is selling print on demand products. So this is if you're searching for, I know I often search for things like band t-shirts and, you know, football t-shirts, because I'm the bit of a nerd on Amazon and Etsy and websites like that. So this is, you see those generic t-shirts where, you know, you can get the logo of your favorite band printed on it on t-shirts in like 10 different colors. And supposedly, according to TikTok, a way that you can make money is to become the kind of person who sells those products. So you make the design, you list them on Etsy, but you get a third party company to actually make all the t-shirts. And you can set it up automatically. So people buy these, it goes to the printing company, they make them and send them to the person, but you obviously get a cut of the money once you've paid the people who print them. Tim Armee says this is idea is somewhere between good and bad, can work, but it's not as easy as it sounds. There's loads of competition, and you obviously need to make products that are actually good and not just generic, generic t-shirts that 100 other people are selling. A couple of things he mentions: social media marketing agencies, so getting businesses to pay you to do post them on social media and build up their following. He basically says that idea is completely old hat. It was a great business idea a few years ago, now way too competitive. Loads of people do it. Don't really bother with that one. Another one that I found really interesting, I don't know if this idea to me seems slightly a bit cheeky, but clearly you can make a lot of money from it. So it's reselling free furniture that you pick up on Facebook Marketplace. So if you're on local Facebook groups, you see people say, oh, I'm moving house, I've got this chest of drawers, I'll give it to you for free if you come and collect it today. This business idea is basically you go and collect a bunch of furniture like that for free from people, and then you sell it on for money, which is, you know, personally, I feel a bit bad about that. I think, you know, people think, oh, I'm giving this to this nice person, they'll use it in their house, but then flog it onto someone else. I mean, yeah, fine way to make money, but I personally feel a bit bad about it. But Tim Armee says, if you're okay with the morals of it, actually really good way to make money. Easy to start, easy to do. And yeah, if you've got a lot of spare time to do that, to be, you know, moving furniture around and, you know, probably got a car and a couple of mates to help you out, he calls it the perfect side hustle. So that's a good one. And the last one, faceless YouTube videos. So I'd not heard of this, but this is where you basically pick a sort of trending topic that a lot of people are talking about, and you make essentially a mini documentary using AI to put on YouTube. So you go to something like ChatGPT and say, here's the example of the financial crisis. You go to ChatGPT and you say, write a script explaining the 2008 financial crisis that can be read out by a voiceover actor. Then you get the script, you go to another app, which will read it out for you, essentially, and make you the voiceover. You upload it to YouTube, and then you hope that it gets loads of hits and you get revenue from the ads. So Tim's verdict on that is, can work, but you need to really pick the right topic. So something that loads of people aren't talking about already, you need to make it interesting, you need to have a lot of detail and obviously optimize it so a lot of people will click on it. So that's his verdict on those five. I was quite amazed that, you know, apparently so many kids are thinking about doing these things. It does really show, like, you know, there are so many different ways to potentially make money these days online. But I think the takeaway from it is, you know, there is no such thing as a kind of side hustle for the lazy person. You do have to put effort in, you have to do the research. And, you know, the holy grail for these people is to get passive income, where, you know, you're just making money from stuff you've essentially put on the internet, and you don't have to do any active work for it anymore. But I think he's saying you need to put the work in first in order to get to that point.
Lee, I was just getting drunk at uni. I don't know what the kids are doing nowadays.
I used to at uni go to charity shops, and there was a couple of good ones because I was in Southwest London, and snap up things for quite cheap and then make quite nice little profits on eBay. But oh, I was also in between getting drunk.
I don't think eBay existed when I was at university,
drink,
in my defense.
Responsibly.
Water, Lee, water.
Just to say, actually, Tim Armu is a kind of regular contributor for us, and he made £1 million very quickly from a company that he bought up and built up, an influencer business. So he was a multimillionaire before he was 30, and he does these pieces for us sort of once a month for the site, and they're always very interesting and helping us keep on top of what's happening, getting down with the kids, because I definitely do not use TikTok. But I think the furniture, you know, I'm a big fan of the furniture flipping stuff, because essentially you could be saving something from going to landfill and giving it a new lease of life. And actually there's an antiques market not too far away from where I live called Battlesbridge. And in there is actually someone who has a permanent kind of space who does up furniture and does all of these trendy pieces, you know, paints them in bright colours, does stenciling, all that kind of thing. And it is a little movement, these furniture flippers. And I regularly see things with a free take me sign outside people's homes, because if you're having a revamp or a refresh of your home and a piece of furniture no longer fits and you don't want it anymore, it can be quite hard to get rid of it unless you smash it apart and take it to the tip. So I think things like that, like, you know, giving away stuff on Facebook, for example, is a good thing, because hopefully it cuts down on waste and people get more individualistic items by, you know, perhaps giving them a new lease of life. But you have to be, you do also have to be careful from a side hustle stuff because of the crackdown that we saw that was announced sort of this year in terms of tax and that kind of thing. But listen, I full hats off to people that get off the backside and do these things and make a bit of extra pocket money. I'm all for it. You know, I'm all for it. I've written a whole book about it.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a great thing.
Never Go Broke by Lee Boyce, by the way, in all good bookshops.
I wasn't going to plug it, but yeah.
You can always rely on me, Lee. No, I'm glad that you both said that it takes a lot of effort, because just even posting, I mean, I've done a couple of reels in my time. That's on Instagram, by the way. Oh, God, it's an effort. Oh, God, I can't be bothered. I don't know how people do it and have a job. Fair enough, if it is your job and you do it properly. Oh, content creation, hats off to you. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
Yep, you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can also comment where this podcast will live. Just a couple of extra things. Number one, I've had an update from my mum. She's managed to log into her account.
Great.
She's won £25. So all of that just to discover that she's won £25. If you are an ISA millionaire or a premium bonds millionaire, please do get in touch at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. Also, the last couple of weeks, we've had some fantastic questions from listeners, and I'm thinking about rounding a few of them up and sort of getting them answered and talking about them on the podcast next week.
Great. So
if you've got a good question, just email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. We'll get it answered and it might feature on the podcast potentially next week.
Even if you've got a bad question, I mean,
there's no such thing as a bad question.
Yeah, exactly. If you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.